I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, President Obama outlined the executive actions he was taking on immigration policy. He complained that the House of Representatives has refused to vote on a bipartisan compromise bill that was passed by the Senate that created a pathway to citizenship and increased the number of Border Patrol agents.
I continue to believe that the best way to solve this problem is by working together to pass that kind of common sense law. But until that happens, there are actions I have the legal authority to take as president, the same kinds of actions taken by Democratic and Republican presidents before me, that will help make our immigration system more fair and more just. Tonight, I'm announcing those actions. First, we'll build on our progress at the border with additional resources for our law enforcement personnel, so that they can stem the flow of illegal crossings and speed the return of those who do cross over. Second, I'll make it easier and faster for high-skilled immigrants, graduates, and entrepreneurs to stay and contribute to our economy, as so many business leaders have proposed. Third, we'll take steps to deal responsibly with the millions of undocumented immigrants who already live in our country.
Anticipating the response from Republicans and his critics in Congress, he said this.
The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century. And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill.
Obama is heading to Las Vegas today to rally support for his actions. Joining us is Laura Meckler. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joins us from the Journal studios. And Laura, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
So how many people do you think will be affected by the president's announcement last night?
Well, in some ways, it might affect all 11 million people living in the country illegally right now, but it will affect in the most dramatic way about 4 million people who will have the opportunity to come and essentially apply for what's called deferred action, which means a safe harbor from deportation, which also gives you a chance for a work permit. So that's the most dramatic impact. There's about another million people who will benefit from other specific provisions of the bill. And then there's another big group of people who may benefit because the president is making clearer exactly who should be a priority for deportation, making clear it should be, for instance, serious criminal threats and people who are in the process of crossing the border. And that might give a sense of a sense of security to others who may not qualify for the special protections, but may be a little less concerned about being snagged up and then deported.
The president used the word temporary protections from deportation. Obviously, he'll be out of office in about 2 years. Do you think that word temporary will keep some people in the shadows?
It's possible. I mean, there obviously is some risk in the sense that there is no guarantee that this will last beyond President Obama's term, and it can be reversed right by a future president. We have some experience with this, with the deferred action program for young people who were brought to the country as children. There are about a million people who qualify for that, and maybe in the 60% of those have actually come forward and applied, and about half are actually in the program, or maybe 60% in the program. So, there are good at least 30-40% of those people who never came forward. So I'm sure all of these people will not come forward either.
It seems the president was focusing on families. First of all, do you think I'm right about that? And also, do you think that has a kind of political salience?
Yes, I do think you're right about that. Specifically, the people who qualify for this special sort of protective status are people who have sort of ties, deep ties to the country, and how that's being defined is people who are parents of either U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents and who have also been in the country for at least 5 years. You have to meet those qualifications to qualify for this program. So, yes, he is talking about family. I mean, the explanation for why that is true has to do with a few reasons. One, he's trying to sort of protect the people who are the most part of the American experience, who are really connected to this country. But also there is not precedent for it, but there is Congress has recognized sort of the relationship between parents and children in that you are as a citizen, you are allowed to sponsor somebody for a green card who is your parent if they are not a citizen. So this is a little different, but that relationship has been recognized before.
Who do you think has been left out of this, as we understand it, less than 24 hours after the speech?
Well, in terms of getting the special protective status, obviously, you know, more than half of the people are left out of it. The group that's gotten the most attention is, I talked about those young people who were brought to the country illegally as children. They're sometimes called dreamers. Mm-hmm. And they were very much hoping that their parents would be covered. And that is a group that is not being covered sort of categorically. If they qualify in some other way, they will be covered. But just simply by being virtue of being the parent of a dreamer, you don't qualify for this new program.
And how big a change is this? I mean, the president seemed to think it's pretty groundbreaking, but from your perspective, and I'm thinking, I guess the 1980s was the last time there was some major change in immigration policy. Is this historic?
I think it is. I mean, I actually think the president was emphasizing the other way. He was emphasizing the fact that his predecessors have all done similar things. The White House is very keen to make people feel like this is not out of the norm. Other presidents have done similar types of programs before. However, nothing on this scale. And of course, that's what the Republicans say, that this is such a big program that it is, in fact, you know, bends the law to the point of breaking. But it is a historic moment in the sort of history of immigration policy in this country.
To me, it seems like the bumper sticker message from the speech last night is that basically we will not deport most of you. Do you think that's what
right.
he was saying?
Yes, he was. And that comes, like I said, in two different buckets. You know, the people who are getting overt protections from deportation, and then the people who are getting the sort of de facto protections by the president saying, hey, here are our priorities for deportation. If you don't fit into one of these categories, you really shouldn't be processed. You really shouldn't go through the deportation process. You know, we'll see if that happens. Now, that second group of people doesn't get work papers. They don't get sort of that overt protections, what's called affirmative relief, but they do, in fact, have some measure of a little less concern that just because they get, say, stopped for going through a yellow light, that's not going to end up leading to a deportation.
There's nothing about citizenship, or the word citizenship really didn't appear in the speech last night.
Well, this is not a path to citizenship. He does not have the power to do that. This is not a path to a green card. It's not permanent. All of that stuff has to be done by Congress, which, as you know, has declined to pass legislation providing for that.
Well, Laura, one of the things the president said last night, that the Senate passed a bill on a bipartisan bill, as he described it, on immigration reform. He seemed to think that if the House allowed this bill to be voted on, it might actually even pass. Or is there any way to know whether that would happen or not?
Well, I think most people agree with that if that bill came to the floor, it would pass. However, the reason it would pass is because it would get almost every, if not every, Democratic vote, and then it would get a small number of Republican votes. But, you know, the Republicans run the House, and that's not how they run things. It's not how the Democrats ran it when they were in charge either. They don't want to pass a bill that is basically a Democratic bill. They want a bill that's going to have majority support from their own conference. So, but of course, there are many people, certainly this year we'll see with the new Congress, but who have believed that there is majority support in the House with substantial Republican support, maybe not for the Senate bill, but for something very similar. However, there was a decision made earlier this year that for a variety of reasons, political among them, they were not going to bring that to the floor this year.
So what options does the Republican Party have to push back on what the president did?
Well, that is a topic of much discussion on Capitol
I'm
Hill
sure.
and has been for the last week or longer. They're trying to figure out what they can do. The bottom line is, as I see it, is they have very few really viable options. They can try to pass legislation undoing it. Well, the president has made clear he'll veto that. They can try to hold up funding for the government. Well, there are a couple problems with that. Number one, it risks a government shutdown, which Republican leadership very much wants to avoid. And number two, the irony here is that the agency involved that administers this program is funded by fees. So even if the whole government shut down, that agency could continue operating because it doesn't depend on congressional appropriations. So that seems like a sort of a bad idea, too. There's also talk about whether they could file a lawsuit to try to stop it. Well, the problem with that is that courts have been made it very difficult to prove that you are harmed by the policy. In order to have what's called standing to sue, you have to show you've been harmed by the policy. And it's hard for a member of Congress to explain why they've been harmed. And the final option, and this is probably the one the president would prefer, is that they pass their own immigration legislation, Republican immigration legislation. Now, that would do a variety of things, both sort of show people what they're for, and theoretically, if they pass something that was to the president's liking, it could replace this executive action. But I think the likelihood of that is very, very small. A more likely would be a Republican-stamped bill on border security enforcement, maybe some changes to the legal immigration system.
And how seriously should we take the impeachment charge?
I do not take that very seriously at all. In fact, I think in some ways Democrats are the ones who like talking about that more, because if that were to happen, I think most people think that all it would do is backfire on Republicans, because it would be seen as sort of an overreach, and you know, Americans would be like, well, you're doing what? So that's probably, and even if you talk, there are some very, very conservative Republicans who have raised that specter. But, you know, the leadership in the Republican Party has just said absolutely not.
Does this create problems for the Democrats?
Well, I mean, you know, this is not necessarily a popular move. The Wall Street Journal and NBC News released a poll this week that showed that there was not majority support. There was a plurality of opposition to the president acting alone. Now, there is support for the underlying ideas and for a path to citizenship, but this policy of going around Congress is not popular with the public. So as even the support among Latinos in this country, it was just a very marginal advantage for this policy. So, I mean, it depends how this is cast. If this debate, in which Democrats are really trying very hard to make this a debate about immigration and about people and about the policy, well, Republicans are trying to make this a debate about executive overreach and why are you not cooperating? Why aren't we working together? I think Democrats have a problem if people look at this and say, wait a second, we just elected a new Congress. Why? They haven't even been sworn in yet. Why isn't he trying to work with them? Now, they have an answer for that, but still, I think that if another thing that our poll showed is that people crave compromise. They want people to be working together. And obviously, this is not an example of working together.
Well, and it's clear that at least the Republicans in the House are not interested in compromising with this president.
Well, you know, that you could definitely make the case. I mean, they're certainly not interested in they don't trust him. They don't like him. They don't really want to work with him. They've made that clear.
Well, and we almost have a little less than a minute before we have to say goodbye. But it seems like the president tried to reframe this amnesty word. He said amnesty is the immigration that we have today. Millions of people who live here without paying their taxes and playing by the rules, while politicians use the issue to scare people and whip up votes at election time.
Right. Well, that word amnesty has become such a political hot button. Anything somebody doesn't like is called amnesty. This is not amnesty in the sense that this is temporary. It can be revoked at any time. Obviously, though, it is a form of forgiveness in the sense that people will be able to come out of the shadows, as you say, as the president says, and participate more fully in American life.
Well, on that note, Laura Meckler, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. In fact, joined us from the studios of The Wall Street Journal to talk about president's speech, his announcement last night, taking executive action on immigration policy. Shifting gears after this very short break, we'll be talking about Young Involved Philadelphia. We have three guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. The 2014 State of Young Philadelphia has been in full swing over the last week with panel discussions and events aimed towards the needs and interests of the millennials who are playing an increasingly important role in this city. A Pew report earlier this year found that the recent increase in 20 to 34-year-olds in Philadelphia was greater than in any other major city in the United States. So what are their hopes for the city? What do they want as residents? And will they still be living here in 10 years? And whoever wins the mayor's race next year will have an impact on their lives and some of these decisions. Let me introduce our three guests to you. Michelle Freeman operates her own marketing agency called Witty Gritty. She also serves as the publisher of the online magazine Flying Kite Media. She currently serves on the board of Spiral Q and Franklin's Payne Skate Park Fund and was named an emerging leader by the Philadelphia Do-Gooder Awards. This was back in 2013. And Michelle Freeman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Ben Stango. He's currently getting a JD and MBA at the University of Pennsylvania Law School and the Wharton School. In addition to his core work with Young Involved Philadelphia, he serves on the advisory board of the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program and the board of the Free Library of Philadelphia's Raven Society and the advisory board of the Citizens Planning Institute. Ben Stango, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Kellen White. He serves as the Community Engagement and Special Project Manager for Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown. He's currently the co-director for the Philadelphia chapter of New Leaders Council, and he's also the founder of the Pattison Leadership Group. And Kellen White, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
as
well.
Thanks for having me.
So broadly speaking, what is the state of Young Philadelphia? Ben, go ahead.
Sure. So State of Young Philly has been around for about 5 years now. It's part of Young Involved Philadelphia's larger mission of creating a new generation of leadership in town. This year, we've gone bigger than ever before. We have 22 events, hundreds and hundreds of young Philadelphians learning about Chinatown, talking with local CEOs, figuring out how to run for office. We kind of cover a wide range of ways in which young people can get involved here and become really great Philadelphia citizens.
And to you, Michelle, I know you grew up in the area, went to Drexel mm-hmm. University. So what has kept you in this city?
I think it's been just an ongoing ongoing journey of sort of opportunities to be engaged. And I actually do think that I went to Drexel, so I think that the co-op program really helped that. I ended up working full time much earlier and getting involved with a lot of civic engagement activities early on.
And how about for you, Kellen?
Well, I grew up here and then left to go to college in North Carolina and ended up in Minnesota doing sports marketing, where this would be like spring. And then I just came home.
Not today.
And coming home, you just realize how much you love Philly and how different it is in every other city in the country, and you just want to be a part of it.
So I'm curious, and I'm back to you, Ben, but I'm also curious about, so what is your vision for the city? I mean, you've put down some roots here.
Sure.
What do you want the city to do? What do you think is on the sort of top priority list?
Yeah, so I think we know the issues that matter most to millennials, and those are the issues that matter most to me. It's about education. It's about jobs. It's about the opportunity to create a family here and to live a great life. But I think you have to place that in the larger context of where is Philly right now along its own timeline. You know, we tend to hold ourselves back, and we've done that forever. We limited how
really,
high
it's historic.
Yeah, it's historic.
Part of the DNA.
Yeah, for a while we didn't allow buildings over a certain height, and we limit our sights in a lot of different ways. So I look towards making this city world class, putting us in an international context, and bringing all that that has to offer here into our borders.
I guess same question for you, Michelle, which is in terms of those priorities, I think education is probably on the top of everybody's
Absolutely.
List, but we know this is perhaps the most challenging issue facing the city as well. Mm-hmm. What else on your list?
Sure. I mean, I'm definitely in agreement with Ben, but I also think quality of life for our age group is really important, and also safety. You know, we live in a large metropolitan area, and I think that's also a very key thing that we need to remember.
How about for you, Kellen?
Both the things that they said, but also finding ways to fight poverty in the city. Because I think a huge pushback we see for our generation is neighborhoods get, you know, revitalized, young people move in, and the people who live in neighborhoods feel as though they're being forced out. And I don't know any millennial that moves into a neighborhood and says, yeah, I really want to get rid of all the old families that live here, but it's the way things are going. If, you know, you're a young millennial who has a good up-and-coming job, you move into a neighborhood, and the person next door to you is living in poverty, there's going to be that disconnect. And if we can find ways as a generation to help fight that, I think a lot of the bad blood that I don't really think exists but gets overblown would be cleared up.
Well, and I should just add to that that the city, I think among the top 10 cities, has I think the highest rate of poverty.
Yeah.
And it's in certain ways kind of systemic poverty. It's deep poverty, as it's been called.
Yeah.
So you see that as trying to figure out how to I guess, build bridges across the millennials, all of you, you're college educated, you have jobs, you're working, you are professionals, trying to bridge that kind of a gap.
Yeah, and I think fighting poverty touches on all the issues that was education and safety and quality of life all gets rolled into one.
You're nodding your head, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the big barriers we face right now is that even though there's this incredible millennial movement, we're not all talking to each other. So millennials in Manayunk aren't talking to millennials in Mantua. Millennials in Center City aren't talking to millennials in Nicetown. So we need to find the ways to bridge that to make one Philadelphia and to work on these issues together.
And why aren't people talking? They're just too busy?
It is a big city. You know, it's a small town, but it's a big city. So you get, you know, the neighborhood focus is a part of that. And a lot of people are coming from very different places. So part of what we have to do is demonstrate what are the issues that bring us together.
Right.
And it's these things like jobs and schools and safety, and then find ways to create the forums where we can interact with one another.
Well, and Michelle, you have a small business in the city, and sometimes business people say that this city doesn't make it easy to open shop. You're smiling, maybe to keep from crying. I don't know, but true though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that there's more attention that the city is giving to those issues, but like Ben said, I mean, it's, you know, things are slow moving. You know, you want it to move faster, and you know, how much time do we let go by where we're losing all that opportunity to have business owners, you know, do business here and grow here. I also think in that sort of space, this is becoming more and more known as a startup town. So you have all these startups, they're very hard to track. We don't know if they're staying and growing here, if they're leaving. But oftentimes I hear that this is a great place to start a business, but not stay and grow your business. So I think that's the piece that we really have to focus on, is how to keep these businesses here and give them the resources that they need to grow.
Yeah, you're nodding your head, Kellen.
Oh, and that's also something that's deeply historically Philadelphia. Like, a lot of things were started here, and then they leave. And I used to be a big sports fan. I always joke around that, Reggie White.
I feel your pain, yes.
Reggie White, Charles Barkley, they were in Philadelphia, and then they became Hall of Famers. You know, it's like one of those things where, as a town, and we get that image in sports where, whoa, we're so tough on people, but it's not just in sports. It's in everything, and, you know, businesses, and et cetera.
But why do you think that is? I mean, I'm not disagreeing with anything that you're saying, but why do you think is the sort of resistance either to change or to sort of, you know, believe in ourselves or to be more proactive on some of these issues?
I think the real challenge is that people still have this very narrow view of what the city can be. So if you are a dreamer, if you're someone who wants to build something, create something, you can start it here. We say Philly's the original startup. You know, we started America, so we can do pretty well with startups. But then once you want to scale it, when you want to look internationally, we're not a city that does that yet. So until we expand our horizons generally, when you want to create something, it looks like you've got to go somewhere else. That's something we've got to change.
Michelle?
I think that also to add to that, I mean, we need to also look outside of ourselves as a city. You know, we're here, we live here, we look at our issues here, but how are we competing on the national scale? You know, other cities are faster moving on some of these things, and they are more innovative and ahead of us, you know, and we have to really look at that and pay attention so that we can, you know, build up to that
scale.
Yeah,
it's tough when you talk to friends who are all across the country and you say things like, no, we have some issues with Uber. I can't get home late at night.
Yeah.
And they have no idea what you're talking about because it's just incomprehensible that there's so many ways in which we could be so far behind.
Right.
Let me quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Ben Stango, also with us, Kellen White, and Michelle Freeman, all of them involved in Young Involved Philadelphia. In fact, events going on over the last week, and I'm told there's a love fest tomorrow night at Impact Hub. I just showed my age there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, especially if you're part of this young cohort here in the city of Philadelphia. Call yourself or others call you as a member of the millennial generation. And to you, Kellen, and you work for Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown. We're beginning to see the rough outlines of a mayor's race. There are four people that have officially announced: Lynn Abraham, Anthony Hardy Williams, Terry Gillen, and Ken Trujillo. How important do you think the mayor's race next year is for your age group?
I think it's a make or break point for us. I think either we're going to rally behind a couple issues and get those issues pushed through and help elect a mayor, or we're not. And us not doing it is going to be that moment where we either see the fight or flight, where the millennials, because right now we think, because we're so large, we have a huge impact, but the numbers don't say we do. So the mayoral race, everyone's going to be paying attention. We'll see. There will be some candidate that will emerge that the millennials love. And if they win, then millennials will feel like we have arrived. If they lose, then we have to go back to the drawing board. And I think either way that happens, it's going to cause the millennial generation to finally shore up its ranks and try to move forward.
Well, let me ask you about political engagement. We just had a governor's race, and the turnout was pretty paltry, not just here in Philadelphia, but across the state. And one wonders, and because I'm talking to the three of you, if there's a problem of sustained engagement then?
Yeah, I think it's something that we have to work on, and that's why Young Involved Philadelphia exists. So we're working on registering voters and turning out the vote specifically for millennials right now. And that's about changing elections. So we know that we undervoted pretty much every other age group during off-year elections. But in 2012, we outvoted every single age group. So there's huge potential. And the candidates recognize this. Every single declared candidate has done something with millennials already. Which I think that bodes well for the fact that we, our issues, our role is being taken seriously.
But even just taking the governor's race, and I mean, there's a clear choice there. I mean, they were not a Tweedledum or Tweedledee type candidate.
Right.
There really were choices, and I'm only putting it to you because the three of you are here. A lot of other people didn't vote as well, but for millennials, and if we're talking about education, jobs, the economy, all that, I mean, it's not the city, but it's the state.
Right. I mean, I think it goes back to what Ben was saying, that this millennial demographic is vast and there are a lot of us and there is a lot of disconnect within that. And for those who are engaged, if you really look at that percentage, it's probably not that large compared to the larger group. And those who are engaged tend to talk to other people who are engaged. So how do we actually figure out those ways to get connected with others? And that's a really big challenge. And I know that's probably the biggest challenge for people who are running for office, but it's also a challenge for people like us who are trying to do the work that we're doing, and we're busy, and you know, we do have to remember to kind of lift our heads up and look around and try to reach into places that we're unsure about or you know, are unaware of.
Does it need, though, Kellen, is there a need for just millennials who run for office, whether it's on the really super local level or city council? You know, you work for a councilwoman.
Well, I think it goes beyond that we need an agenda more, because education, poverty, crime, every single person who lives in Philadelphia would agree that those things need to be fixed.
Yes.
I look back at the boomer generation, and they had the Vietnam War and civil rights, where almost the entire cohort of the young boomers were like, this is wrong, we need to do something about it. So across the country and in small towns, people were running on that. Here in Philadelphia, there isn't an actual issue that millennials are like, this is our issue that we own. And if you come out for this issue, we're going to come out for you. Because every single person who ran for governor, on at least the Democratic side, said we need to figure out how to fund education. So it wasn't like we were behind one guy. And I think we're going to see that in the mayor's race. I am sure every single mayor is going to talk about education and saying it needs to be better.
Well, and part of that is this is essentially a Republican town. I mean, it's a one-party town. I don't know, Ben, if that's a problem or not.
If the fact that Democrats just dominate in
Philadelphia. Yeah, you don't have a kind of a two-party battle.
But I think you still have plenty of battles within the Democratic
Party.
Yes,
you do.
So, yeah, we're not wanting for battles. But I think that what we have to do and what candidates have to do is connect abstract issues with what matter to people's lives. So the reason why a lot of people don't vote is because they don't recognize that, oh, they might not be able to send their kid to a good school because they voted for a candidate who's going to defund schools, or they didn't show up and the candidate won. So it's that type of work. And then I do think it's about millennials running for office. We actually forget that we've done okay with this so far. We elected Brian Sims. He's a fantastic state representative. We've got people who are part of our generation who are running Old City District and at high positions in the school district, and people who are positioned and ready to lead. And that's just the beginning. And behind them are thousands and thousands of millennials who are ready to step up. So I'm hopeful.
Are you hopeful, Michelle?
I am hopeful. And I also don't think it has to be about like a millennial takeover. I think it has to be about more of this connecting of the generations and the leadership. You know, I think it's, you know, I mean, I've noticed so many more people working in the city of Philadelphia for different departments. I think that's fantastic. I do think we do need to encourage more young people to run for office. And I think something that I know that John Gieding talked about at Ignite Philly a few weeks ago was not just about throwing a bunch of young people in office and that's going to fix everything, but it is about finding the young people who want to invest in Philadelphia and be here for the long haul to take that path of politics.
Yeah, that's the powerful thing is that this is decades that we're talking about. We're here and we're committed to staying. So what we do now is just the beginning of 3-4 decades of work that we're investing in the city.
Because, well, you referenced the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement of the 60s. I mean, that took time.
Yeah.
Took a long time.
And I think, you know, it's about being patient. Like, I talk to people all the time that, yeah, we're young, but historically we're just now getting to the age where we would get elected in Philadelphia, even in like the 20s. And it's a hard battle to run for office and not having the experience. So it's about finding people who might want to run for office, not in 2015, but say in 2019, and then helping them be able to do the work so that when they run in 2019, they're not just some young kid who thinks because he went to an Ivy League school he can run. He's a young kid who did work in the community, built a coalition, and now has a legitimate reason to run. That is kind of like what Jason Dawkins did, who became a state rep this past election. He took time. He said he looked at it for 4 years. He built up in the community over those 4 years. So when he ran, age wasn't an issue. And once age isn't an issue is when you kind of get open that door where you can get in, and then the change can happen.
Ben, I'm thinking about all of what you three are talking about.
Sure.
I mean, do you think that the political system in the city is interested in you? Interested in your ideas?
I absolutely think so, and that has not always been the case. So Terry Gillen and Ken Trujillo have both had Young Friends events. Senator Williams has a really young staff, a lot of young people there. And Lynn Abraham had a meeting with a small group of millennials not too long ago. They all are interested, and they all recognize that we can be a potent force. Now it's up to us to turn out.
I mean, there is strength in numbers. I mean, the baby boomers learned this, but there are many more millennials than even boomers.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, too, because from the candidate standpoint, they're trying to figure out how to mobilize millennials. But I also think that from the millennial standpoint, we're trying to figure out how to mobilize ourselves. Like Kellen had said, we have to, like, figure out what our agenda is, you know, and not just name off the, you know,
education and environment.
Yeah, same five things.
The thing that's sort of yours, uniquely yours, you mean?
Right.
The issue
that stands out, so that these candidates can kind of get behind it and give us some type of explanation or response as to where they stand on whatever that issue is or set of issues it are.
And we know that there are going to be things that come up that are extremely complex. And the reason why – so what's important now, Kellen and I have talked about this a lot. It's about eating and drinking together now so that when we're fighting about things we can't even anticipate in the future, we can do it with friends.
Right. We are talking with three members of Young Involved Philadelphia. That's Ben Stango, also with us, Michelle Freeman, and Kellen White. And we want you to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I didn't know this, but there are 11 million more members of the millennial generation than are in the baby boomer generation. They're also the most racially diverse group in U.S. history and probably the best educated. They are transforming a number of cities, including here in Philadelphia. In fact, one of the reasons the city's population has been growing in recent years is because millennials either staying put or moving to the city. And again, our guests are Kellen White, Michelle Freeman, and Ben Stango. And again, taking email comments at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, I have an email from Larissa. I'll just quote this. I'm hearing a lot of discussion about the needs of millennials living in Philadelphia. But as a fellow millennial, I'm a little bothered by this focus on this one very specific demographic. The term millennial has a very specific age, but also class connotation. I would love to hear the guest thoughts on how to close the education gap in Philadelphia. For example, how do we work to solve Philadelphia's problems without making it, as one guest just termed it, a millennial takeover? And I know, Kellen, you want to take that first, but I'm going to toss it out to all three of you.
I would also argue that millennial isn't a class connotation at all, that I think the media has skewed it as the highly educated young people that live in Center City, but anybody in the generation, no matter where you live or what your education level is a millennial. So the education gap is a massive millennial issue, and it's just the silent millennials that no one thinks about in the media that are affected more by it. And I think, you know, as millennials, we talk about, oh, we have these needs. When we say education and jobs, we're not talking about I want my PhD and I want to be CEO of Comcast. We're talking about having a kid. You know, maybe you're living in North Philly and having a high quality education and being able to get a job that might not be a full-time career, but a job that allows you to make wages and take care of your family. And so I think the message gets lost in that people think us millennials only care about Center City mm-hmm. and the extended Center City. But mm-hmm. in reality, I think more so than almost any generation, we actually think about all classes at all times because we were raised to believe that everybody were equals.
Ben, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Kellen's spot on. You know, Greater Center City is the focus because that's where a lot of people in our age group are moving. But if we only have good schools and good places to live in Greater Center City, then we have failed as a generation. This is about the entire city. It's about every neighborhood. It's about every child. It's about every family. And that universal view is something that I think the older generations don't even have right now. It's very parochial. Our view, it's about everybody. It's about one Philadelphia. I really think that that's something we embrace.
You want to add to that, Michelle?
Sure. And I also think, you know, I think a lot of times it's easy to say to use the word millennial and then say what quality of life do they want and then just come up with a laundry list of, you know, beer gardens and bike lanes and cool music venues. But really what it comes down to is everybody in Philadelphia, like Ben was saying, deserves a quality of life, access to education, access to resources, and a place where they feel safe, you know, a place where kids can play in a safe environment and a place where people can raise children and grow together. So, you know, I think the media sometimes can throw millennials in with this like hipster sort of image, yeah. but it's such a big, much bigger group.
But wouldn't you say the bars and the bike lanes that for some millennials that has been a draw?
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, that's just, yeah. That's also, you know, part of the.
I think it's the lowest bar of entry. Like, no pun intended. That people think, oh, I
it's
like bars and bike lanes and, you know, beer gardens. Okay, I'll vote for this guy because he likes it too. You know, I wish it was a deeper thing than that for some people, but I'll take it if they're voting.
Yeah, but it's one of the unique things about the city is that we bring in people because it's a great place to live, but then they stay because they have these incredibly difficult issues to work on. So you can go to your beer garden, you can bike there in your bike lane and have a great time, but then spend the rest of your night figuring out how to do some really great community work up in, you know, Tioga.
Well, we have some callers that looks like they want to talk about that you know, point at which you have a child or two, and then they'd be, you know, where do you send them to school? And for some people in the city, I mean, they have maybe more choice than they had 10 or 15 years ago. But nonetheless, for a lot of people, you just choose what's in your neighborhood. But for some people, it is a choice about whether to stay or whether to go. Michelle, I'm tossing that to you.
Yeah. I'm like, that's a big one.
It is a big one.
I mean, I think, you know, and again, this goes back to, you know, the engaged versus those that don't. That are not as engaged or feel like they don't have options. You know, I think that there are great groups in the city like Philly Core Leaders and lots of parents that are becoming more vocal and more involved. And those are the schools, and this is coming from somebody who's a little bit outside of education, but these seem like these are the schools that are building and becoming stronger, the ones that have parents who have relationships with the principals. Now, there's a whole other piece of that with, you know, the fact that the district has many schools and a lot of those schools don't have that happening. So how can we find the best practices and then try to replicate them across neighborhoods and communities.
You want to add to that, Kellen, and then we'll get to Jennifer to join our conversation.
Well, I think there's two issues with that. I know I used to live in Graduate Hospital, and Chester Arthur has a great engaged, millennial-driven friends group, and their school has improved because of it. Other schools in the area don't have that, and it's not that school's fault. It's just different circumstances. But I think step one is, in the areas where people have the ability to do that, they should do it until we get legislative relief from the state side where it's like, okay, now we have the money to make every school great. And it's encouraging to see how many millennials who don't have kids. I work with the Mount Airy Schools Coalition. I just got married, but kids are not on the radar. But you work there because you want – and it's not about my kids in the future. It's about all the other kids that are there now. I want everyone to have a quality education. So one day when we're the leaders in Philadelphia, we have an educated workforce that's helping making the city better. And whatever generation after us is going to be called are better than we are, bigger than we are, and smarter than we are.
Well, let me get Jennifer from Point Breeze to join our conversation. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. It's Jen DeVore.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Jen. How are you?
These are actually three of my good friends on the line, and they know that, you know, I talk about this all the time, as do other you know, millennials. But, you know, there really is a misconception that it is all about us, right? It's about getting our kids into the right school, our amenities, our new construction. But I think we all know so many people where it is so much more than that, and we are fighting to uproot the bigger issues. And I'm just wondering, like, what do we do about that misconception, and how do we start to change that conversation and make, you know, Native Philadelphians and older residents and people who have really founded the great communities that we have now moved into, collaborate and work together more? I mean, I know that's a really tough question, sure, but I figured I'd just shout it out.
Well, no, I'm glad you did shout it out, Jennifer. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, not to plug Radio Times, but in part, that's what we're talking about, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I think Jen's talked a lot about this, and it's a big challenge. I think the answer is we've got to prove it. There's a lot that we can do on a small level and a lot that we can talk about, but until we're able to make some serious change that affects a lot of people, it's going to be tough to break that misconception.
Do you do that through politics? Do you do it through local activism?
If you move into a neighborhood and you invest in that neighborhood and you demonstrate to people who've been there for decades, in addition to the folks who moved in last week, that you care about making that a great place, awesome. If you do it through legislation as elected official, that's fantastic too, across the board.
Kellen, you mentioned earlier this issue of gentrification. You know, as you say, millennials moving into certain neighborhoods in Philadelphia, they may not want to push out the residents who have been there, but it often happens. It's an artifact of sort of real estate and how real estate works. Can that be prevented?
I think it can, and I think there can be measures that would help that. And I believe that on all levels of government, people are working on that to have that happen. But, I mean, the easiest way for millennials to not seem as though they're alienating themselves is talk to your neighbors. Like my neighbor, I have two neighbors who are elderly women that I help carry their groceries when they need help. Like, and I talk to them and we have conversations and they always say stuff to me and my wife, "You guys are such nice young people." And it's because the other young people in the neighborhood just walk by them. And when you're in neighborhoods like Point Breezes where your neighbor might look at you and think you're an outsider, knocking on the door when it's snowing out and saying, "Hey, you need help shoveling your snow," will go a long way into at least repairing that relationship on the hyper-local level, and hopefully it will grow.
Let me get Leslie from looks like Bluebell to join our conversation. Leslie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I know that this is primarily about younger people staying in the city, but my husband and I and our teenage children, we just recently purchased our second home in Old City. Rather than buying a beach property or something at the shore, we still live in the suburbs, about an hour from Philly, but we have this condo. We closed on it just a couple weeks ago, and we see more of our friends doing this. So it's a lot of us are coming back to the city because it's a place you can use year-round, great restaurants, great shopping, great museums. And I think I just want to make the comment that it's not so much just young people, but the older people are coming back to the city.
Les, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I do believe that that is true, and lucky you to be able to do that. Anything you want to add to that, Michelle?
Sure. I think in building off that comment, if you look at this year, and I was born and raised in Philadelphia, this is a really exciting year for development and amenities to that point. You know, I mean, what's happening on the waterfront? Finally, there's a plan and it's being implemented. We can see it happening. There are plans for Market East. You know, I mean, the Navy Yard has some exciting things coming up. So it's you can see it and you can feel all of that time we were kind of waiting and all of the people who were working on it behind the scenes. It's all sort of coming into fruition. And I feel like this year was actually a very turnkey moment. Also, SEPTA and their new technology system is exciting.
That's a good thing as well. Do you all care about the fact that it looks like there will be a second casino in Philadelphia? Is that an issue? I'm looking at you, Ben. That Young Involved Philadelphia has gotten involved in?
It's not an issue we've gotten involved in. I don't know if that's how we want to fund things is through gambling. But hey, if it's bringing in money to the schools, then I'm open to pretty much any idea that anybody has.
We have a tweet from looks like Ayn. How will millennials govern differently? It's an interesting question. I'm putting that to you, Kellen.
I think the State of Young Philly is actually a great example of how millennials work. You had 22 events. I believe 3 or 4 were Young Involved Philadelphia events, and the rest were other groups, some millennials, some not, that collaborated together and put on these events. And that's what we do like the group project generation that we grew up in. It's like, oh, the 4 of you are going to take a tri board and make something. And so we're used to it. And we also know that we think we're smart. We also know we don't know everything. Mm-hmm. So I think if millennials kind of are able to gain power, whether it's political or professional, they will collaborate more. And I think that's where, you know, we want the city to go. And I think if even elected officials now, if they were collaborating more, there would be less of a angst by young people. Like, you know, you look at Congress and everything, they're not doing anything. And that's why young people want to run. Mm. But if we see them collaborating, then you know, that's how we would govern.
To play well with others, is that
yes.
what you're telling us?
We all did well on that in kindergarten.
You did. It did well. Well, there's something to be said for that, believe me. Let me get, looks like Aaron from University City to join us. Hi, Aaron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm excited to hear millennials talking about being involved in politics, which I think is a good thing. But as someone who's a little older than most millennials, in my early 40s, I'll say I moved to Philadelphia in part because I love its historic architecture, its streets, its feel. And I wouldn't want to see all that just plowed out of the way in the name of making life happy for millennials. I don't think I speak just for myself in this regard either. So I'm hoping that that point of view can be incorporated into discussion today.
Well, Aaron, let me just say, I don't think millennials or anyone is talking about plowing out some of these historic. They wouldn't be allowed to do it anyway because they are protected.
Actually, one of the reasons I call is that increasingly the Historical Commission is not observing its own ordinance, and this is happening more and more. I'm responding specifically to something Ben said about height limits. Happy to see tall buildings come into the city. Don't want to see it come at the cost of the city's historic buildings.
Okay, fair enough. And no, it's a good point. Ben, you want to respond
yeah,
to
no,
that?
Yeah, very fair. I think that you know, there are limits to everything we should do, and we're not going crazy. And the history of the city and that architecture and what it brings is a lot of what inspires us to be here, that you know, way back when we created something pretty incredible and we can do it again. So we've got to be smart about how we approach these things, but we can't hold ourselves back.
We have a tweet from Sophie. Philly is a wonderful city to live in, but needs more jobs across broad sectors to thrive and help people stay. I hear that coming from all three of you. Michelle, you
sure.
want to comment on that?
I think that's definitely the case. And I think that, I mean, that's probably a very good agenda item for the millennial yeah. demographic. And I also think that we also do a bad job of letting sort of people know what jobs are available. I think that, you know, everybody, you know, in nonprofits, often it's the case that everybody's really busy and heads down, maybe not don't have the time. Startups certainly, when they're growing and have, you know, have business or jobs available, don't have the time. And I mean, and there's just a disconnect across all of that. And there are all these little tiny, you know, hashtags and websites that attempt to be a job sort of aggregator to let people know what jobs are available. But I think that's also a piece of it, that there are some jobs available, but not right. The mechanism to let people know.
Kellen, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are some jobs available, but not nearly enough jobs available. And I know, I remember coming out of college, everybody went to Atlanta, Washington, D.C., or New York, and they all got great jobs right away. And my friends who went to Philadelphia were like, okay, I'm going to go to grad school, you know, and I'm going to wait
because
and figure out what
jobs.
I want to do. And, you know, we don't have those big corporations here. And even out of the Minneapolis, Target, General Mills, and 3M were all based in there. And everyone you met out was from Target, General Mills, or 3M. And you come here and we have Comcast, you know, obviously, but we don't have that. And I don't know if it's a tax issue or what, but if we can get more big businesses here, and there's been a lot of movement among elected officials to try to bring good paying jobs, whether they're factories or corporations here, to help that. And that would keep people.
We're almost out of time here. So what was the great millennial mouth off? What was that about?
Oh, so that was a really wonderful conversation that we had with a number of CEOs throughout the regions and millennials talking about policy issues that matter to them. So we had AJ Raju and Sam Katz and Jane Golden, an incredible collection of people, having a real back and forth. So this is a lot of what Young Involved Philadelphia does, is we are able to create these bridges between people who've been here, have been doing the work, and those who want to step up and start doing it themselves.
Well, we are out of time, and my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times and telling us a bit about what you want for this wonderful city. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And they're all involved with Young Involved Philadelphia. Ben Stango is currently getting both a law degree and also an MBA at the Wharton School and at the Pennsylvania Law School. Michelle Freeman has her own marketing agency called Witty Gritty and serves as the publisher for the online magazine Flying Kite Media. Kellen White serves as the community engagement and special project manager for Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds Brown. And I should add that there is a love fest tomorrow night, part of Young Involved Philadelphia at Impact Hub. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.